Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Don Fusick, and I'm an alcoholic. How are y'all? Are you willing? Come on, I can't even hear you. Yeah, there you go. All right. As you know, willingness is the key. We have the key up here. We're going to pass that around. So if you're not willing, grab hold of it. I'll give you some more. How's that? Here we go. We've got to start that. How about that? My home group is a Tuesday night step group, and my sobriety date is January 5th, 1979. And I tell you that to show that this wonderful program of action works, spiritual program of action. Let's have a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 75 years. How about that? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And without further ado, let me do two or three things. One is I want to introduce Michelle, our archivist at GSO. Michelle, please stand up. And I want to thank Michelle and the committee for giving me the privilege of chairing this meeting. You know, there's nothing like archives. If you don't love archives, then, you know, that's your business. But archives is the whole key to this program. It's the heart of the fellowship. I mean, talk about the language of the heart. When you talk about archives, you talk about 25 or 30 exact events that must occur exactly on time, or none of it works. And we're not here. We're still getting stoned to death like they used to be. And fortunately, we're not doing that. At any rate, I was privileged to serve as the Area 15 Archives Chair, and also the 2003 National Alcoholics Anonymous Archives Workshop Chair in Fort Lauderdale, and also the 2008 Florida State Convention. And I'm privileged to serve as an out-of-town trustee for Dr. Bob's House. And, you know, if you don't love archives, then I suggest you read AA Comes of Age. And when you're done with that, read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, and pass it on about Bill. And you will develop a love for the archives. And be careful, though. If you get bitten by the archives bug, it never lets go, right? At any rate, we have three great speakers all involved in the archives. We're going to try to tell a great archives series of stories for you. And first of all, leading off is Richard. And he's the Area 73 Archives Chair. And without further ado, Richard is from West by God, Virginia. How about that?
My name is Richard. I'm an alcoholic. It's wonderful to be here. What an amazing thing to be asked to speak. This is my first international affair, and to be able to come up here and share a little bit with you is just amazing. I do serve as the Area 73 Archivist for the state of West Virginia, and it's a joy to do that. I look at archives as like a living, breathing entity. You know, last night in the Alamo Dome, I'm sitting there, and my first convention, and people were doing the wave, and I'm sitting there, and I just broke down in tears because I couldn't believe that I was sitting there from where I was 10 years ago. And then I started to think about the gifts and the people that have come before in 75 years of this fellowship. And then I looked around and I was thinking, a vision for you. It's been a vision for me, but it's also been a vision for you and a vision for you and a vision for you. And then I started to think about all over the world and then the people that recovery affects. Like, not only just the people that are sitting in there recovering members of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, but the 20 or 30 or 40 people that make circles around them. And then I just couldn't stop crying. And I leaned on some people that were at my first meeting. They were sitting next to me, and that was pretty cool. So, you know, last night, now when you go home and you talk about the flag ceremony and things like that, that's an archival event. You know, you'll get to go home and say, I was at the Alamo Dome. It was incredible. And there was 90 countries and their flags come out. And you're sharing a piece of archival history to all your friends and other people in the fellowship. So I feel a little bit passionate about the archives. I do believe that you do carry the message with the archives, and I hate to see the archive just sitting in boxes with a bunch of dust on them. So I like to get the archives like from our state and share it and tell the stories. And really, that's what I do. I'm a storyteller more than anything else. Now, there's parts of archives where we conserve and preserve and catalog and inventory, and we do all those things. And I'm pretty decent at that. There's a lot of people that are a lot better than me at doing that. But what I really love to do is take the history and share it with people. So we keep passing it on. So grateful. This gentleman here was, in a way, was talking to me about when I heard him say about all these events that happened like that. I consider that like divine providence. How could things happen in a certain way? And when I first got asked to do this, I thought, what should I do? It's you know, archives, a collective vision. Wow, that left the door pretty wide open. And I thought maybe I could bring some of my archives here. I'll have them shipped down by FedEx, get some spotlights on them, maybe record a little thing with music and stuff. And I thought, you know, I'm still an alcoholic. and then I said, well, maybe I should write up something and I'll just read it off real well. And I said, that's really not what I do. So what I thought was I just like to speak off the top of my head. And so the topic that I thought I'd talk about was the debt of gratitude the Fellowship of Alcoholics owes non-alcoholics, the people that have made AA possible. And even today, you know, where we hold our meetings and the people that support us, from the jails to the pastors and the rabbis and the priests and the friends and the medical community and the psychiatric community that support the fellowship. Milton Maxwell, Henrietta Seiberling, Lois Wilson and Ann Smith. You know, today, wives like that would be considered enablers or in a state of denial. Thank God they didn't divorce their husbands. And look at what they have done, how they have helped the fellowship. Ann Smith and her strong spiritual background, reading the Bible and reading part of James and faith without action is dead, and that was her favorite part. Lois Wilson, the beginnings of Al-Anon and the support there. Henrietta Seiberling, who just heard Ann's talk and wanted to help Dr. Bob because of her ties to the Oxford Group. The list goes on and on. So what I thought I'd focus on was one particular person. The person I thought I'd share about today is Sister Ignatia. Sister Ignatia, born in County Mayo in Ireland in the late 1800s to a very poor family and an agricultural family. And they would all go into town to meet at the pub, because in Ireland that's where all the town information was passed along. And there would be people, neighbors and stuff, that would be in the pub and get drunk, and the kids would be on the street, and they'd come out and chase them on the street. And little Della Mary Gavin would run away and talk to her mom, go, what's going on? And she says, well, the alcohol is a demon, but never, it changes people. They came to this country so her mom could get an operation, ended up in Cleveland, Ohio. And little Mary Della Gavin loved music, voice, the piano, the violin. She gave herself to the Sisters of Charity of St. Augustine in 1917, and they assigned her to an orphanage. She loved it. It was just everything that she would have anticipated doing. And she got to teach music to these orphans. She was so good at it that the diocese there had opened a music school up in Lakewood, Ohio, and they decided to bring Sister Ignatia to this music school at Lakewood. She made it to Lakewood, and now these were paying clients, and she was getting more and more, 10 a week, 20 a week, 30 a week, 40 a week, 50 a week. And after doing this and working 6 days a week for a number of years, she suffered a severe nervous breakdown on a trip over to Indiana. It was so bad she couldn't raise her arms above her shoulders. And almost paralyzed and laying in a hospital, a doctor said to her, you're either going to be a dead music teacher or a living sister. What's it going to be? And she had a dark night of her soul, where she started to ask God for help and question what was going on with her, and decided that she wanted to be a living nun. And they assigned her to be the registrar of St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, Ohio. What an amazing turn of events, because in Akron, Ohio, being the registrar there, she was the one that assigned doctor's cases, and that's where she met Dr. Bob. A few years passed, and it was the first hospital that admitted the first alcoholic, and really almost became like the forerunner for treatment in this country. And the first time that Dr. Bob wanted to bring someone, he told the sister that it was a problem with alcohol, and he had already conveyed his problem with alcohol, and she identified with him because of her past experience. And she looked at Dr. Bob and says, sounds like a bad case of indigestion, because they had to admit him one way or another. And Dr. Bob says, yes, sister, chronic gastritis. And they got this gentleman and began their work. They became best friends. Every Christmas Eve, they would spend the Christmas Eve in the alcoholic ward there at St. Thomas and have a quiet dinner together. Dr. Bob passed away in 1950, and Sister Ignatia was hurt. She'd lost, really, her soulmate. And in 1952, she was asked to go to Cleveland, Ohio, at the St. Vincent's Hospital to start an alcoholic wing. And the people lined the streets from St. Thomas Hospital. Alcoholics lined the streets to wish her a farewell. And when she arrived there, she got some help to rebuild that. And just an incredible, wonderful soul. So I could go on and on. I don't want to take too much time here, because I know we have two other wonderful speakers who are going to talk. But when Sister Ignatia passed away, and it was 1966, they were going to have a small gathering at the Nuns' Chapel there. And all of a sudden, the phone lines were just buried with phone calls and Western Union telegrams coming in, and the sisters went to the bishop and says, look, we're going to need to maybe get a bigger facility. And so they opened up the cathedral in Cleveland to do that. And that day when they gave the eulogy and the funeral, the church was filled. There was over 400 people outside the church that they had speakers so they could hear what the eulogy was. The bishop at that time also thought, well, we need to get a history on Sister Ignatia. We should get a history, because look at this outpouring. It was people from all over the world, all walks of life. And the father that gave the history, Father Coonan, they decided that he would be the historian. And they gave him some of her collection and some of the materials that she had saved. And he was in New York about 3 or 4 months after the funeral, and they found him dead in his vehicle. Alcohol, and he had thrown up and asphyxiated himself and died there. A lot of the materials were lost, only a few pages of the manuscript. But I was just thinking about non-alcoholics. Non-alcoholics. When I first came in, it was alcoholics. I want to talk to an alcoholic. You better come from an alcoholic. My mom don't understand. My friends don't understand. No one understands. And so, I don't know. I just, something different at this event, I just thought I would mention a few of the many non-alcoholics that I think we owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to. archives for me is really telling those stories and keeping it alive. I love to share with new people what has been shared with me. And we do pass it on. We do pass it on. The state of West Virginia has a tremendous archives, and I'm blessed to do that. A lot of people collect these books. We have all the first editions. They're all to me, that really isn't the essence of what the archives are about. If you have a big book and it's signed and it was from a past delegate, and there's a story behind that delegate of what meant to that delegate and how it's been passed on to everyone else in that area, that's the heart and soul of the archives. I'm not in the collection business. Thank you all so much for letting me share a little bit of our history, and God bless you all. Thanks.
Thank you, Richard. That was an excellent talk. You know, Sister Ignatia is one of our favorites. You know, there's a couple quick stories about her. She was walking down the ward and big ward with maybe, 10, 15 beds. And it's late at night. She worked like 18 hours. And some guy comes up and pulls on her hand. Sister, pray for me. She says, she smacked his hand out. She says, oh, pray for yourself. God loves to hear from strangers. You can't make this stuff up. It's hilarious. Now, that's not typical of Sister Nancy. She's very loving, caring, and it was funny. I just love that. She's also responsible for handing out these Sacred Heart medallions. From 1938 to 1950, Dr. Bob and Sister Nitch got over 5,000 drunk sober in St. Thomas Hospital in Akron. Before they would leave, she would give them one of these and say, before you take a drink, you must bring this back to me. And that's how AA Medallions got started. So if you want to get some of these, you can get them at various stores and hand them out and tell them, before they take a drink, they must bring it back to you. So that's all for that. But with our next great speaker here is Bob, and Bob M. He's the past delegate, panel 47. Past Area 54 Archivist here, and past Area 54 Archivist. And come on up, Bob.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I borrowed that line from a guy named Dr. John P., who was the professor in The Professor and the Paradox that was in our second edition big book and now in Experience, Strength, and Hope. And we archivists steal from the best there. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Bob M. I say it that way for a couple of reasons. My co-sponsor used to say he said alcoholic first because it always reminded him to place principles before personalities. And I usually am very free with my last name, but they ask us not to use that when taped, presumably taped, events. And while I don't agree with that policy necessarily, I do comply with it. I don't agree with every policy in AA. I try to comply with them. I'm not the arbiter of right thought. I'm now the archivist for the Cleveland Central Office. Before I forget, this book is going to go to the Cleveland Central Office, but it lacks something, possibly your signature, if you'd pass it around. I'm also the archivist historian for the statewide functions of the four general service areas in Ohio. Neither of these is a title that got me on the GSO records database, but I'm the area registrar, so it was very simple to make myself the district archivist for District 32 of Area 54, which contains my home group, the Borton Group. I'm not sure my DCM knows this, but he's speaking at a meeting he's chairing a meeting starting right about now, so nobody's going to tell him this. I'm a member of both the Area 54 and the Akron Intergroup Archives Committees, and by AA's suggestion, I joined my city's Historical Society, and I'm now their assistant curator there. So archives has got me into all kinds of mess there. I used to look at archives like my father's Oldsmobile, and history was very dull to me, dull memorization of dates and people far removed from anything I understood. But I went and studied physics in school and learned about action and reaction and stuff like that. And I came to AA and I kept looking for the chapter in the big book that said why it works. And the old-timers told me that wasn't any of my business. My sponsor told me for the first 2 years not to read anything about AA history. And, of course, this made it all that much more interesting. So in year three, which was 1986, for me, I zipped through AA Comes of Age, Dr. Bob and the Good Old-Timers, and then the fairly new book, Pass It On. And this time I read history much more excitingly as a cause and effect. And then I stopped. Things in general service were taking much more of my time. 10 years later, I was an elected delegate, and I went to an OEPA convention because it was held at a hotel where we were about to have a general service event, and I wanted to scope the place out. And after about an hour, the noise and the antics drove me into the quieter archives room where an adult named Gail held court. And learning who I was, a delegate, she pointed a long, bony finger into my chest and exhorted, "We need a conference archives committee." Yeah, she's about to give me the finger again. but she invited me to the second AA archives workshop and gave me a Sunday morning to explore this request. And I invited the GSO archivist and two delegates in attendance to talk on what's a trustees committee, what's a conference committee, and how do the two interact. And the last delegate drove home a principle. This isn't an archives principle, but it's an AA principle. If you want action that requires conference approval, you need to convince two-thirds of the conference to do it. You need to talk to your delegate. Again, you've got to talk to your delegate if you want things done at the conference. We brainstormed and voted, and I wrote up the results, which became part of the background material, aiding in the formation of a conference archives committee as a secondary committee. We wanted two things done specifically. We wanted a workbook and we wanted a pamphlet on archives, and both of those have been accomplished through that process. I just scanned one vote, that's all. General Service partnered with the Akron Intergroup to host the third archives workshop, and our cooperation was so amicable that the intergroup noticed it, and when they no longer needed a room in their suite, they offered it to General Service at a very, very nice price, and we grabbed on this opportunity, and it became our archival repository. This is an archives principle. Do not store your archives in a private residence. They don't belong in private residences. Rumor has it that shortly after the demise of the state archivist for a related fellowship, her husband threw out all that old stuff. Well, we filtered the lighting, put plastic over the, I say we, the guy named Jim here somewhere, it did a lot in that regard there, to prevent water leaks and mounted shelving. I got the archives in three egg cases from our previous archivist. Now, there's a problem with this. Egg cases are meant to carry eggs, not volumes of paper there, and you mostly fill one of those things up, and they weigh over 80 pounds there. So that's you need a very sturdy archivist there. Archives is usually where old AAs go to die.
Now.
What you call an attorney with an IQ of 80 is your honor, I think, something like that. Sorry.
Bring the judge.
I transferred these first to archival storage boxes, which are a normal storage box kind of thing. And then we settled on document cases as being the best choice for how to hold these things. We got a large donation from an old-timer. part of it was kept in a crawl space in his basement and rather badly mildewed. I promise not to talk much on conservation here, but please don't keep this stuff in your attic or your basement there. I wrote a mission statement and expanded that into a collection policy for our archives. You need these two items to remember what you're about. You need a mission statement and a collection policy to remember what your archives is about. There's a tendency as new archivists to take anything that comes your way. And an archive quickly has a way to absorb all time and space to it. Eventually, you have to pick and choose and be ready to refuse, discard, or donate some items in your collection. The Akron Intergroup and the Northeast Ohio Area Archivists decided who would be the better custodian for some items, and we deaccessioned them to each other. To know where we stood, I took inventory. You know, you need an inventory to know what's yours. Jay here is inventory expert here for Akron, and was very helpful in my putting together. I'm a applications computer programmer by trade, among other things, and I wrote an inventory system geared to our collection, and part of it was the ability to create a deed of gift document from a series of entries. You don't own it until the previous owner signs it over to you. It isn't yours until you can prove it's not theirs. Another archivist points to an item in their collection that's either a loan or a gift, depending on the current mood of its original owner there. Also, one of the eight intergroups in my area claimed that most of their archives left when their administrator retired. But was it theirs or was it his? They had no documentation. What I've seen there since shows that a lax or non-existent access policy to their holdings led to attrition of their materials. One can hope that the current possessors of these things will get to their ninth step, but I'm not holding my breath. You need to limit and monitor access to original materials in your collection. We owe this diligence not just to the organization we serve, but also to the many donors who grudgingly parted with their treasures so that they may help others understand and appreciate our fellowship. Two other notable things happened at that workshop. One guest speaker was Ernest Kurtz, author of Not God, A History of Alcoholics Anonymous. He and Paul L., then Stepping Stones archivist, beseeched me to get Cleveland Central Bulletin Newsletter, AA's oldest periodical, digitized and searchable. Kevin S. did most of the work to get these first 50 years of the newsletter scanned, and this CB on CD, as I called it, produced and available through Cleveland's office. And I also asked Ernie what our area archivists should be doing to get started. He gave a two-word answer, oral histories. I wasn't really familiar with what those things were. We embarked on a small set of histories, concentrating first on our past delegates. And I stalled at this because I knew that most of these were useful if and when transcribed, but my typing speed is nowhere near talking speed. So it was very difficult for me to do it. Nor could I find volunteers who would not, or people who would not only volunteer, but actually do some transcriptions. I've since learned something of indexing, which is essentially an outline of the talk and serves this purpose without the speed and volume needed for a transcription, and this is less taxing. We started doing oral histories on cassette recorders and now do them on digital recorders, which brings me to my final topic here, digital archives. I hope I'm not talking too much into your talk here. GSO archives and much of the archival community as a whole kept harping as paper archives are a time-tested method of preserving records, and digital records are much more volatile. This is true. I hate the oft-used term data filing cabinet for a computer hard disk, in part because I've never watched a metal filing cabinet completely destroy itself within two quite noisy seconds. But on the other hand, I can put the contents of a whole filing cabinet onto one DVD and duplicate it even by slow means in half an hour. I can store this copy somewhere else, keeping these data immune to loss by theft or fire. Furthermore, some records never have been and probably never should be impressed onto pulp. But digital contains its own problems. Akron was hosting the 2006 AAWS Intergroup Seminar, and we wanted to invite the then relatively new archivist, Amy Filiatro, to attend. The general manager said, what would she do there? So we put together two workshops for her to participate in, and I asked her to address digital archives at our Archives for Amateurs workshop. She stressed migration. I should say I was a volunteer for the National Park Service at one time, and I had to be very careful how I used the term migration around there. They have different meanings there. But it's a catch-all term in data processing for three different actions. Upgrading media, for example, 5 1/4-inch floppies to 3.5-inch floppies to CDs or to DVDs these days. Upgrading format, such as Microsoft Word 97 to 2007, or even Lotus 1-2-3 to Excel 2007. Or backup, taking an older CD and copying it onto one or newer CDs, hopefully an archival CD. Some of these claim like 300 years, but I understand 40 years is more like a practical limit, and most likely you will have to redo it because of the other two migration reasons there long before that. And she also addressed digital photographs. You can't write on the back of a digital photograph, but you can and should change the file names to reflect something of what they are. And you should delete the less needed pictures when it costs a lot of money to get these things developed and printed and things like that. You were a little more careful about what you, taking the picture itself. And I'm thought to be a good photographer because I throw away about as many pictures as I keep. I've also since spoken with Michelle Mirza. When we're talking about people who are non-alcoholics who are dedicated to AA, I think we should also remember Judith and Amy and now Michelle there, who are very dedicated AA employees. And but we talked about modern paperless records, and she introduced me to something called PDF/A. which I'm looking into. The A is R for archives. This is Adobe Acrobat, archival method that apparently is somewhat accepted, at least in some archival areas. An archive's a lot of work, and it's not always appreciated. One archivist referred to us as the red-headed stepchildren of AA service. Usually I love either archives workshops or grapevine workshops. This room is really rather crowded, but I hate packed rooms, so either the archives or the grapevine workshops work out for me. The end result is astonishing. Most folks only see our displays, which are an important but small part of our archives work. One outstanding display was done by the Akron archivist, Gail, and a team of helpers. I mentioned Jay and Jim here and many others. Cody. I've taken groups of people down the timeline of the Akron Intergroup office over 100 times, and I still find myself amazed at our history. I delight in the smiles and nods of these visitors when we impart the phenomenal story of our beginnings. Dr. Carl Jung referred to such things as synchronicity, several seemingly unrelated events all coinciding to make something wonderful. We leave these guests truly inspired by passing the AA message and our legacies of recovery, unity, and service from us, its caretakers. I'm honored and pleased to have had this opportunity to talk about this arcane, indirect form of AA service that I do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. That was excellent, and it does cover a lot of the various stuff that we have. You mentioned a couple of the more recent archivists. We also owe a debt of gratitude to Nell and Nell W., our first AA archivist, and our second one also, Frank M. A lot of you know him and that. So there were certainly others involved, but we'll leave that for another time. But now we have our third speaker here, David C. He's the past Area 72 archivist and archives chair. He's also the current District 35 archivist. And he was chair of the 5th National Alcoholics Anonymous Archives Workshop. David, come on up and give us some information. David's one of my best friends, and we're very active in the NAW.
Hi, everybody. My name is Dave, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 26, 1993. This is my first international. Wow. I've been to a lot of other archives functions, and I'd like to right now say thank you to a very special person in this room. I'm on a fixed income, and I was not able to afford to come, and this wonderful lady, out of the goodness of her heart, said, "You're going to the international." So I want to thank Phyllis here for letting me come. You know, I began this wonderful journey as an archivist for Alcoholics Anonymous in 1995, starting at the district level and becoming the archivist for Area 72 in Washington. It was very strange. I was a district archivist, and people said, "Well, you should put your name in for to be archivist, be area archivist." And I said, "Well, God, you know, I only have 4 years. I don't know enough to do this." And they said, "Well, just go ahead." And, you know, I said, "All right, well, you know, there was a whole lot of other people that, you know, put in their names, too." And I didn't realize at that time that Area 72 was going to split into 92, and the repository was going to have to be moved. And so that last year, I just kept my hand up, you know, and sat at the front room saying, "I'm still available, I'm available." I didn't bother to turn around behind me to see all the hands come down when they all realized what they were going to have to do. And by the time it came to vote, I was the only one with my hand raised. I became the area archivist by default.
There you go.
What a wonderful journey, though. The road I've traveled has taken me across the country and allowed me to meet many people in and out of this service position. I began to attend the National Alcoholics Anonymous Archives Workshop in 1998 and have been attending ever since. After my workshop rotation was up as area archivist, I returned to my roots as a district archivist and have been very happy taking care of the needs of my group and fellowship. I have to refute a few things that my colleague here said, you know, about getting rid of things. I was told, you know, don't throw anything away, give it to AA. And then I was also told, you know, give it to me and I'll decide to throw it away. So as a result, I keep everything. I currently am the caretaker of our district archives in Kirkland, Washington, and we have over 750 pieces in our traveling display. It takes 3 hours to set up. It's quite extensive. But, you know, the people that come and see it get a real chance to see a lot of material. I can understand when, you know, you say, you know, get rid of things because it wouldn't take so long to take care of things. But that's all right because, you know, I came to the realization that, you know, there are people out there that are going to want to know about things that happened before myself. It's very, very amazing. There's a guy in this room that I met at the first national workshop that I went to. And he was from Daytona Beach, Florida. Now, I knew that the guy that founded AA in Washington, a man by the name of David W., we knew that after he had spent some time in Washington, he moved on to Daytona Beach, and he started the meetings there. And here I was in Akron for my very first time, awed by all of these things that I'd seen and heard. And I met this man from Daytona Beach, and I said, well, do you know Dave about Dave W.? And he said, yes. And he goes, do you know about Dave W.? And I said, yes. And I realized that the two of us had come from across the country and met at the birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we were talking about the founders of AA in our own cities. What a joy and wonderful thing that was. But, you know, I asked him, I said, do you have a photograph? Because nobody bothered to keep one of them. Nobody bothered to keep one in Daytona Beach either. Area 72 in Daytona Beach does not know what our founder looks like because no one kept his photo. As an archivist, it's my job to take care of those things. But, you know, I'd like to talk to you today about preservation and conservation of materials in Alcoholics Anonymous. Books, documents, papers, and other memorabilia are collected and maintained by archivists. Preserving our archives is essential if we are to carry the accurate message to those that follow us. Can you imagine what AA would be like if nobody cared enough to practice preservation and conservation techniques so that 75 years from now, there were very few reminders of our past? Think of that for a second. 75 years. It's wonderful. What's going to happen at 150? Where are all these things that today we take for granted? Bob's passing around a book. It's a first edition because it's the first printing of that softcover book. In 75 years, it's going to be just like our first edition of our big book. Something to think about. Webster's dictionary defines preservation as maintenance of something, especially something of historic value, in an unchanged condition, or in other terms, to protect. Conservation is defined as the keeping or repairing of something from change, loss, or damage. Repair. As archivists, we have the duty to protect and keep our collections and files in good order. How else will future archivists know how to access the data or look up information from those very collections? You might say we can do that now electronically. We should always be mindful that in this age of electronic storage, the one proven method of permanent protection is writing on paper. Even after 4,000 years, we can still read Egyptian hieroglyphs. That's pretty long time to have something written down. As archivists, we should look to preserving 20, 50, even 100 years in the future. I can't think of just today or yesterday. I have to think of tomorrow, too. I have to think of the things that I'm collecting today are going to be history tomorrow. Only paper can be said to remain for over 100 years in a relatively unchanged manner. We do need to keep up with technology, even in the digital and electronic media of today, but also to remember our tried and true history of writing on paper and preserving it. The reason I say this is that as of today, there are no guarantees for the long-lasting storage of data on CDs and in other forms of electronic storage. Yes, manufacturers all say their CDs will last 25 to 100 years. But the simple fact remains that they're made out of organic compounds that degrade over time. And you begin to lose data. Once the organics in the plastic discs start to degrade, you start losing things on the silver data part. When that occurs, you'll be unable to retrieve the material. Data stored in other electronic media can be lost simply because of the advances of technology. Storage on MP3s and in hard drives are susceptible to damage from many sources. Even if you put the material into external hard drives and store it in a safe place, time will take its toll. All it takes is one lightning storm near your house, and it blows out everything in your computer and it's gone. You'll never get it back. You need to back up that data so every so often, or it will get lost. And when you upgrade to future technologies, it needs to be redone or you will lose it. People don't realize that when they put something on their computer and down the line they decide to upgrade, you need to upgrade everything else that you've got too. If you put something on a CD and you get a better CD, you need to put it onto the better CD. Because if you don't, as time goes by, you're going to forget about it. And then when you go back, or the future archivist goes back, to try and retrieve that material, they won't be able to access it. How many archives have procedures in place that do all that? That do that upgrading and do that material upgrades whenever things change? Not too many, I think. Something to ponder about. The reason I say this is that you need to preserve all of our treasures in whatever form they are. As a conservator, it is my job to look at documents, photographs, books, and other memorabilia with an eye on how to keep these items for the future. I need to be mindful of storage practices and environmental damage that might affect the items in the collection. In this world, there are many factors that can cause irrevocable damage from the environment to the handling of objects. I need to be prepared to repair or protect those precious pieces. Many of our earliest books and documents are now starting to degrade and fall apart. Some of the older books that predate Alcoholics Anonymous are becoming so damaged that little can be done to protect them. With a little work and some diligence, thought, we can all be made aware of how to take care of our collections. There are many classes and people out in the world who can point the archivist or even the collector of old materials toward the right way to take care of their respective displays and boxes of memorabilia. At this point, we need to understand the many differences between archivists and collectors. A collector usually acquires objects for private use. Archivists prefer to allow public display of objects. Collectors tend to offer pieces of their collections for sale, usually for a profit of some sort. Archivists will often keep their collective exhibits intact and go to great lengths to keep it that way. People who are collectors find that in the process of collecting, the act itself becomes a passion. They also have been into collecting in some form or another for most of their lives. Archivists have the same passions to acquire items. I know I do. But the possessing of these items usually is done without the personal attachment that so often affects collectors. Collectors will often go to great lengths to obtain pieces for their collections. In the case of Alcoholics Anonymous memorabilia, Some collectors will pay exorbitant prices to obtain rare pieces. Archivists, on the other hand, usually don't have the vast sums of money to buy AA items. Well, some do, but not me. We usually rely on donations from our fellow members. Historians also enter the picture along with various authors. We deal in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there are resources available from within and without the fellowship. It's my feeling that we should be using these fellow travelers. In history, historians can also help us find alcohol-related materials that we may wish to include in our archival collections. They may also feel they are archivists of sort and can benefit from the same teachings we need to take care of our materials. As an archivist, I think I am a collector. I know the feelings I get when I hold a document or book, and that helps fill in the gaps in the history of our fellowship. I also know that those pieces need to be looked after and protected. As time moves on, less and less of these older items become available. There's only so many books out there. There's only so many items. And when they're gone, they're gone. Documents and books need to be protected from anything that will degrade paper fibers. Moisture, heat, ultraviolet light, acidity, and handling all cause damage to paper. Water releases paper binder and promotes mildew and rot. Chemical reactions that cause degradation of paper store up with increased heat, so protection is imperative. Handling paper transfers moisture, acids, and salts. Acids cause the paper to turn brown and brittle, so procedures to reduce all these factors of decay need to begin or permanent damage occurs. All items need to go through a procedure when you get them, whether it's an established collection or a new acquisition. You need to record it, then assess it, clean it, remove staples, paper clips, remove the damaging tapes. You need to protect the item from future damage, whether encapsulation or placing the item in a suitable folder or box to prevent deterioration. You know, we collect letters, old and new, for posterity, show our beginnings and evolution of our fellowships gone through. I have flyers and banners of our hometowns and states to preserve, keep photographs of functions. All these things and much more do we do as archivists. Most people think that archivists only collect the old stuff. Well, that's not true. You know, we collect the daily things too, because the stuff we pick up today, the things I picked up from this international, are going to be part of our archives collections. Too often damage occurs when misuse and bad storage conditions prevail. There are only so many books in print. As I mentioned before, there are classes to do all these procedures. There are people in most major colleges and historical societies in the cities that can help you to learn these techniques and skills. You can attend the National Alcoholics Anonymous Archives Workshop that's put on every year. This year it's going to be in Macon, Georgia. And there we learn how to do all sorts of things. I've got a few flyers up here in the front if you need. The information booth has them here. You can find more information by talking to one of us. By learning how to conserve and protect items in AA, we also learn how to take care of our own materials in life, be they genealogical histories or how our own part of the world came about. There are so many reasons to care for materials new and old that I cannot relate all of them. Understanding which factors lead to the beginnings of the deterioration of paper and photographic materials allows us to start conservation from the earliest opportunity. We need to understand the materials we are working with and to protect them from environmental damage. Try to stabilize deterioration and repair the damage, if possible, as needed. But we must always, always remember, never do something that cannot be undone. By implementing conservation techniques, we can begin to preserve our history for future members of our fellowship. It is this responsibility to Alcoholics Anonymous and all that has been generated through these 75 years which allows us to preserve our history and pass it on. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. All righty. Thank you, David. That was an awesome talk. And to give you a brief feel for what it is to do the Archives Workshop, and we would urge you all, if you caught a little bit of the bug, you know, and I see a number of you archivists out there, we are going to be in Macon, Georgia. We'll get a little bit more detailed stuff, and you'll get to learn how to preserve your archives so the folks that come along in 50 years will be able to see what we see today and even then some. We urge you to continue and preserve and maintain your archives, this to ensure that the folks who come after us will know where they came from, like we do, fortunately. I want to thank you all for coming to a wonderful meeting. We're going to close with the Lord's Prayer for those who choose to join us. And let's give another hand to our speakers here. Yeah?